Naomi had identified 7 critical positions and built candidate profiles that Saba could use to flood the job openings with his allies. It was important that the people not be false identities, but actual people with real histories and qualifications. If they managed to get 2 of the 7 positions now, it would be enough to give them an edge on later ones. 3, and they'd be able to cover their own tracks well enough that prying them out would be difficult, even if Laconia became suspicious. 5, and Saba would effectively control the Baragaon complex expansion. She'd also identified problem issues. The chief administrator of Zahanet province on Baragaon 6, the planet they called Al-Halub, was a close friend of Carrie Fisk and openly supportive of Laconian rule. It was important that the projects based there be deprioritized and his personal influence undermined. Labor unions on the gas giant's moons had ties to an old inner planet's hate group and still fought against everything the transport union did with the zeal of the self-proclaimed oppressed. Saba would need to create other allies there. The local government had a communitarian faction that was growing more vocal about armed resistance against Laconia that would bring more scrutiny without gaining any useful ground if it wasn't reined in. "You can't fight a shooting war armed with paperclips," Bobby said in Naomi's imagination. "Watch me," Naomi answered. Her voice echoed with the music in the container. A pinch of annoyance bothered her. She closed down her files and pushed the monitor aside. In the time since she'd left Sol System, she'd hoped that their last conversation would have lost some of its power, but like a splinter under her skin, it bit a little every time she touched it. "When 2 people get in a fight, and only one has a gun and the will to use it, that's a short damn fight." Only it wasn't Bobby's voice that said it this time. It was Amos's. A few decades flying the same ship together had built little versions of her family in her head, made some part of them a part of her, even when she didn't particularly want them to be, even when the little mirrors of them only told her that their conversation wasn't finished. She hauled herself up out of the couch, the gimbals hissing as she shifted. She turned the music to a brighter selection with a clearer, faster beat, something to push her. It was early in her day for a workout, but she needed to move. As if working the long muscles of her arms and legs and back could relieve a tension between her and people not present. "It's never a short fight," she said as she hooked resistance bands to the top of her container. The fasteners had been painted gray when she'd first stepped into her little box. They were bright, raw steel now. "Last time I fought it, it was generations old before I even stepped in the ring. We can't shoot our way to peace." "Peace isn't the only good victory condition. How about just shooting our way to freedom or justice?" Naomi sank her feet into the floor loops, braced herself, locked the bands in place, and pulled. It was hard work. It hurt a little, but hurting a little was the point. The voice in her imagination wasn't Amos's now, but Jim's. "That's the thing about autocracy. It looks pretty decent while it still looks pretty decent, survivable anyway. And it keeps looking like that, right up until it doesn't. That's how you find out it's too late." "I'm fighting," she said, then grunted and pulled down hard again. "The quiet work's still a fight. It's a better one. It's one we can win." "Not in our lifetimes," Bobby said. And that was the point, really. That was the deep, true thought that Naomi was working her own way through with all the beloved voices in her head. Sweat was pooling at her hairline. 1/4 G, not quite enough to pull it down her face. Her arms were trembling with every pull. She made herself go slowly, watching her form. It made the work harder, which she liked, and it made her less likely to injure herself, which was critical. Slow, careful, focused, avoiding damage. Feels like it ought to be a metaphor for something, Jim's voice said, and she laughed at his joke. Growing older was a falling away of everything that didn't matter, and a deepening appreciation of all the parts that were important enough to stay. She had unhooked the bands and started repositioning them to work her back when the alert came, chirping on her couch monitor and her hand terminal at the same moment. She wound the bands up and put them away. She'd finish later. The monitor had a single notification up. The comma had picked up an encrypted message that matched her confirmation signature. Out in the depths below Oberon's ecliptic, the bottle had broken, and its data had all spilled out. She grabbed a copy out of the ship buffer and had her system run a comparison. There would be some degradation. There always was. But there was also repetition in the signal and checksums along the way. It would take terrible luck or a very high radiation event to swamp her work past the point of recovery. She only made sure because it was the right thing. All the files and reports opened from the copy as they had from the original files. The system's final verdict popped up with a click like someone snapping their fingers. No unrecoverable loss. So, that was done. Another round of analysis, a new set of orders and recommendations released to the wild. She had, of course, already started on the next one. She enjoyed the sense of accomplishment all the same. She shifted to the news feeds, purging the unflagged copies local to her couch and replacing them again like dipping a cup into a fountain that never ran dry. Tapping her finger against the screen, she paged through the items the system thought most likely to pertain to her. A minor election on San Nang had gone unexpectedly to the second-ranked candidate, a move she had recommended in her bottle before last. A code farm on Mars had partnered with Medina Station to build a new security infrastructure, which wasn't what she'd wanted, but had been on her list of acceptable fallbacks. A security alert had gone out in Sol's system. A red flag, but without the details to say what it was. Except that whatever it turned out to be, she knew what it was. Bobby's war. The one with guns. Somewhere out there, far enough away that even light speed meant hours, Bobby and Alex were risking their lives. Maybe losing them. There was nothing she could do. Frustration washed over her. Or maybe she just became aware of what was always there. She'd chosen her role. She'd picked her place, helped with designing the little dried shell game pea that she lived in. There had been a dozen other ways she could have worked with the underground, thousands of ways she could have made a new life without them. She was here because she had chosen to be here. The container had felt like solitude, not isolation, a refuge where she could wait for the mud in her heart to settle and her mind to become clear. It had seemed like a good plan at the time. It had seemed to work. Now, her fingertips hovering over the security alert, she wasn't sure it did anymore. With a tap like she was killing an insect, she shut the news feeds. Her data analysis was still up behind it, cheerfully reporting no unrecoverable loss. "Seems like that should be a metaphor for something," she said, and imagined Jim's laughter beside her, trading the same joke back and forth between them like they had in better days. Then a moment later, "God damn, but I have to get out of this fucking box." Chapter 9. Teresa. Carrie Fisk was the president of the Association of Worlds. It was, Teresa knew, a measure of how important she was that President Fisk was allowed to meet with her father over breakfast. Teresa sat at her father's right at the little table, and Fisk sat opposite him, so Teresa felt a little like she was watching table tennis, listening to them talk. "A trade compact between Oberon and the Five World Group does have some real advantages," Fisk said. "By picking a handful of systems to really focus on, we can make progress quickly." Oberon or Baragaon can bring another 3 to 5 systems up to self-sufficiency in 7 to 10 years. Then each of those systems can take on clients. The geometric growth model brings all the systems up much faster than having every individual colony be an equal priority. Her father nodded slowly. It was a gesture she recognized. He glanced over to her and raised an eyebrow, a little gesture of complicity. Teresa could feel Fisk squirming a little. The woman was so anxious for her father's approval, it was a little embarrassing. Teresa shrugged. Just a few millimeters of movement that meant, "Do you want me to ask?" Her father nodded. "What about corruption?" Teresa said. Fisk laughed. "Oberon's reputation precedes it. Governor Rittenhour assures me that it's under control. There were a few bad apples, but that's to be expected in an unregulated colony. Now that it's under Laconian supervision, the problem is being addressed." Teresa nodded, then leaned back to see how her father responded. He was slower. Teresa took another bite of her eggs. The yolk was runny, the way she liked, and she sopped it up with a bit of toast. Kelly, her father's personal valet, brought Fisk another coffee. When her father sighed, the defeat was clear in Fisk's eyes. Just for a moment, and then covered over. But Teresa had seen it. "The architecture is good," he said. "I'm not certain these 5 are the right worlds to lead with. Let me review this and get back to you next week." "Yes, sir," Fisk said. "Of course." After the breakfast meeting was done, Fisk left and Teresa stayed. As Kelly cleared away the dishes, her father stood, stretched, and turned to her. "What did you notice?" he asked. "She was nervous," Teresa said. "She always is," her father said. "That's part of why I chose her. When people get too comfortable, they get loose, sloppy. What else?" She knew that the corruption question was coming, and she focused it on Oberon instead of how the 5 worlds were selected. "Was she trying to cover something up?" "I don't think so," Teresa said. "It looked to me more like she knew Oberon had a bad reputation, and she was just reaching for the obvious thing. When you focused on the world selection, she seemed relieved." "I agree." "All right. That was interesting. I have a military briefing from Trejo and Sol System. Any interest in reviewing it?" The answer was no. It was peer class day, which meant seeing Connor. More than sneaking out to see Timothy, more than playing with Muskrat, more even than being with her father, she wanted to go to class. But she also felt guilty about her desires. She didn't want to make her father feel like he wasn't important to her, especially when it was a little bit true. "If you want," she said, making her voice bright and carefree. He chuckled and tousled her hair. "I don't need it. You can go work with Colonel Illich. If Trejo has something critical, I'll let you know." "All right," she said. And then, because she could tell he knew what she'd been thinking, "Thank you."
"Always,"
he said, and waved her on. She knew as soon as she stepped into the classroom that something was wrong. Usually the others were spread in clumps, lounging on the sofas and chairs of the common area, with 6 conversations going on among them. They would notice when she walked into the room, but they didn't make an effort not to stare at her. Today, they had scattered to the edges of the room, leaning against walls or against the pillars like little prey animals that knew a predator was close. Connor was by himself, frowning at a handheld like it had insulted him, and he was trying to keep his temper. The others all glanced at her and then away again. But Connor didn't see her with an energy and focus that felt deliberate.
"I'll be right back," Colonel Illich said, touching her on the shoulder. "I just need to get one thing before we start."
She nodded, dismissing him. Her attention was on Muriel Cowper.
She was a year older than Teresa, with dusty brown hair, a chipped front tooth, and a talent for drawing that meant she did all the face painting at the large group events. She approached Teresa now, and it looked like she was trembling. It reminded Teresa of Carrie Fisk.
"Teresa," the other girl said, could we talk for a minute?"
Teresa felt a little prick of dread, but she nodded. Muriel took a couple steps toward the door to the courtyard, then stopped and looked back the way Muskrat did sometimes, to be sure Teresa was following. In the courtyard, Muriel held her hands in front of her belly like a child being disciplined. Teresa wanted to take them, push them back down to her sides, make her act normal. Muriel's anxiety was like heat from a fire, and it made Teresa feel anxious, too.
"What's going on?" Teresa asked.
Muriel licked her lips, took a deep breath, and looked up, her eyes locked on Teresa's. "There was a camping trip with the school last week, and all of us went, and it was overnight, so a bunch of us snuck out to the water when we were supposed to be asleep, and Connor kissed me."
Teresa felt something. She didn't know what it was, but it lived in her abdomen, just below her navel, and in deep enough that she knew it couldn't be muscular.
The implications clicked over in her mind like dominoes. Connor had kissed Muriel. Not just that, but Connor had wanted to kiss Muriel. Not just that, but Muriel had known that Teresa would care, and so had everyone else. Oh, God. And so had Connor.
"I can break up with him," Muriel said softly, "if you want me to."
"I don't care what either of you do," Teresa said. "If you and Connor want to go into the woods and kiss, it doesn't mean anything to me."
"Thank you," Muriel said, and went back into the common room, almost skipping.
Teresa followed her, trying not to let anything that was happening in her body show in her face. Colonel Illich arrived, as she did, smiling warmly. He had a round, black-and-white ball the size of a decapitated head under his arm.
"Today," he said to all of them, "we're going to be learning some new football drills. The rains made the East Lawn a little damp for the process, so if you fine ladies and gentlemen will please follow me to the gymnasium, you can change into more appropriate clothes."
The middle of the day was filled with echoing shouts and the burn of her legs and back. She kicked too hard and missed more of the shots than she made, and through all of it she felt the attention of the class on her, of Muriel, of Connor. Even Colonel Illich noticed that she was off her game, but apart from a gentle question about how she was feeling, he didn't follow up on it. When the time came to shower and change back into her regular clothes, she didn't go to the locker rooms with the others. She had her own apartments. She didn't need to be with them anymore. Not any of them. As she left, she looked to see if Connor was with Muriel, if they were holding hands, if they were kissing. As it happened, they weren't. Connor was at a brushed steel drinking fountain with hallied marks, and Muriel was pretending that she'd died and had to be carried off the floor by Annika Duby and Michael Lee. Teresa thought it would make her feel better, but it didn't. In the privacy of her rooms, she let herself cry. She felt stupid for having to. Connor wasn't anything to her, but the boy she'd thought about more than other boys. She'd never kissed him or tried to hold his hand. Until today, she'd have said that he didn't even know that she felt different about him. That no one knew. Except now he was sneaking out of his tent with Muriel fucking Cowper in the middle of the night. Who was even in charge of the camping trips that they let things like that happen? Someone could have been drowned or mistaken for prey by a local animal. They were incompetent. That was the problem. That, improbable as it was why she was sobbing. Muskrat forced a thick, prickly nose under her arm, pushing up. The concern in the old dog's eyes was unmistakable. Her thick tail wagged uncertainly.
"I'm stupid," Teresa said. and her voice sounded exhausted even to her. I'm just really stupid. Muskrat coughed out something less than a bark and hopped on her front legs, an unambiguous invitation. Let's forget this and go play. Teresa threw herself down on her bed, hoping that sleep would come or that the bed would open up like in the movies and let her escape to a different dimension where no one had ever heard of her. Muskrat huffed again, then barked. Fine, Teresa said. Just let me put some clothes on that don't stink like sweat, idiotic dog. Muskrat wagged harder, more sincerely. The morning clouds had gone, but the landscape was still soaking from the rain. The water cycle was something that all the worlds in the Empire shared. Any world with life had rainstorms and mud puddles. She walked down the colonnaded paths, tending away from the more inhabited parts of the state building. She didn't want to have any company but her dog and her self-pity. She wondered what she could have done differently. If she'd told Muriel no, that she had to break things off with Connor, she could have done that. She still could, a little. If she went to Colonel Illich and said she didn't feel comfortable with Muriel anymore, she could have the girl kicked out of the peer interaction activities. Even request that Connor spend more time at the state building if she wanted to, and it would just happen. But everyone would know why she was doing it. And so she couldn't. Instead, she walked across the gray-green of the back gardens, looked out at the low, green rise of the mountain beyond the state building's grounds, and wished she could leave or die or turn time backward. Muskrat alerted, dark, floppy ears pointing forward with excitement. The dog barked once in what sounded like excitement, and then bounded away faster than an animal on old, worn-out hips should have been able to do. Despite herself, Teresa laughed. Muskrat! She shouted, but the dog was on to something and wouldn't be turned away. The thick, wagging tail disappeared behind a hedge of lilacs imported from Earth, and Teresa trotted after. She half expected to find Muskrat worrying a skitter or ash cat or other local animal that had wandered onto the grounds. The dog did that sometimes, even though the local animals made her sick when she ate them. Teresa always worried that one of the larger native predators would sneak in someday. But when she made her way around the hedge, the only thing besides Muskrat was a human figure, sitting on the grass and looking out toward the horizon. Graying, close-cropped hair, Laconian uniform without an insignia of rank, an amiable, empty smile. James Holden and Muskrat sprawling on the grass beside him, wriggling to scratch her back. Teresa stopped short. Holden reached out idly and rubbed her dog's belly. Muskrat hopped to her feet and barked to Teresa, "Come on!" Almost against her will, Teresa found herself walking toward the most famous prisoner in the Empire. She didn't like Holden, didn't trust him, but whenever they spoke, he was polite and unthreatening, even a little amused by everything in a vague, philosophical kind of way that made it easy to be polite back. "Hey," he said, not looking up at her. "Hello." "You know what's weird?" he said. "The rain smells the same, but the wet ground doesn't." Teresa didn't say anything. Muskrat looked from the prisoner to her and back again, as if she expected something she was looking forward to. After a moment, Holden went on. "I grew up on Earth. When I was your age..." "You're 14, right?" "When I was your age, I was living on a ranch in Montana with 8 parents and a lot of animals. Rain smelled like this. I think it's the ozone. You know, from the electrical charges. But the ground after a storm had this deep smell. It was like, I don't know, it smelled good. Here it smells minty. It's weird." I've been around wet soil before, she said, almost defensive. That smell's called petrichor. It's actinomycete spores.
I didn't know that, Holden said. It's a good smell. I miss it.
That's my dog. The implied, so get away from her, was lost on him.
Muskrat, Holden said.
And Muskrat thumped her tail, pleased to be included in the conversation.
That's an interesting name. Did you pick it?
Yes, Teresa said.
Ever seen a real muskrat?
Of course not.
So why the name?
The way he asked seemed weirdly open, almost innocent, like she was the grown-up and he was the kid. There was a character named that in a picture book my father used to read to me.
And was the character a muskrat?
I guess so, Teresa said.
Well, there you have it, Holden said. Mystery solved. You don't have to be afraid of me, you know.
She's not. Teresa shifted her weight. The ground under her was still soft from the rain, and he was right. It smelled like mint. A half dozen possible responses came to mind, from turning and walking away to telling him that she wasn't scared of him, and he was stupid to think she was. If she hadn't already been feeling humiliated and angry, she probably would have laughed it off. But it turned out she was spoiling for a fight, and he'd handed her one. He was one of the few people it was perfectly safe to bite at.
You're a terrorist, she said. You killed people.
An expression crossed his face almost too quickly to see, then he smiled again.
I guess I was, but I'm not anymore.
I don't know why my father doesn't keep you in prison, she said.
Oh, I know the answer to that one. I'm his dancing bear, Holden said,
and lay back on the grass and looked up at the sky. High white clouds against the blue, and the glittering lights of the construction platforms beyond them. Teresa understood the game. He was pulling her into conversation. The thing about the rain and the soil, how Muskrat got her name, now this mysterious dancing bear comment. All of them were invitations, but it was up to her whether to play along.
Dancing bear, she said. Old kings used to have dangerous animals in their courts. Lions, panthers, bears. They teach them to do tricks, or at least not to eat too many of the guests. It's a way to show power. Everyone knows a bear is a killer, but the king is so powerful that a bear's just a plaything for him. If Duarte kept me in a cell, people might think he was afraid of me. Or that I might be a threat if I got out. If he lets me out, lets me roam around with what sort of looks like freedom, it tells everyone that comes to the palace that he's cut my nuts off.
He didn't sound angry at all, or resigned. If anything, he was almost amused by it. You're getting your back wet lying down like that.
I know.
The moment stretched, and she felt the silence pushing at her. How many people did you kill?
Depends on how you count it. I tried not to get anyone killed when I could help it.
The thing is, I am in prison. Right now, I'm pretty sure there are at least two very well-trained snipers ready to open up my brain pan if I try to hurt you. So not only am I not inclined to hurt you, I literally couldn't, even if I thought it was a good idea. That's the point of a dancing bear. It's the least dangerous thing at the court, because everyone's aware of it. The ones you trust are always the most dangerous. A lot more kings and princesses got poisoned by their friends than eaten by bears.
Her handheld chimed. Colonel Illich asking to speak with her. She sent an acknowledgement, but didn't open a connection.
Holden grinned up at her.
Duty calls? He asked.
Teresa didn't answer him except to tap her leg. Muskrat hauled herself up to her feet and trundled over, as pleased to leave as to stay. Teresa turned back toward the state building. When Holden called back after her, there was a buzz in his voice, like he was trying to fit more meaning into the words than the syllables could hold.
If you're worried, you should keep an eye on me.
She looked back. He was sitting up. As she'd warned, his back was dark with wet, but he didn't seem to care.
They're watching me all the time, he said, even when it seems like they aren't. You should keep an eye on me.
She frowned.
All right, she said,
and then walked away. As she headed back toward her rooms and the colonel, Muskrat huffing contentedly at her side, Teresa tried to decide what she was feeling. The sting of Connor and Muriel was still there, and the shame at feeling stung. But they weren't as immediate as they had been. And along with them was an uneasiness she couldn't quite fit her mind around, only that it had to do with the fact that Muskrat liked stumbling across James Holden, and she didn't. She found Colonel Illich in the common area. The couches and sofas felt very different with all the other students gone. The walls themselves felt like they'd taken a step back and left a fraction more room for the emptiness. Her footsteps echoed, and so did Muskrat's claws tapping against the tile. Illich was going through something on his handheld, but he stood up as soon as she came near.
Thank you, he said. I hope I wasn't interrupting anything.
Nothing important, she said. I was just walking.
That's excellent. Your father asked me to see whether you were available.
An incident?
Piracy and Sol System, Illich said.
Then, a moment later,
piracy with some unfortunate security implications. There may need to be an escalated response.
Did something important go missing?
Yes. But before we go to your father...
Illich's expression softened. For a moment, he had the same expression she'd just seen on James Holden. It was eerie.
I don't want to intrude, but I had the feeling that there was something bothering you at the peer seminar today.
This was her moment. All she had to say was that she didn't feel comfortable with Muriel anymore, and the girl would never be welcome at the state building again. Or that she wanted to go on the next camping overnight that the school took. Then she could sneak out at night and kiss a boy down by the water. She could feel the words in her mouth, solid and hard as candy. But then Illich would know. He knew already. The ones you trust are always the most dangerous.
Teresa, Illich said, is something wrong?
No, she said. Everything's fine. Chapter 10 Elvie. Something was wrong. She didn't know what it was, only that she had an overwhelming sense of threat and dislocation. She was coughing and vomiting breathable liquid, and Faez was already gone. His couch looked empty and dry. He'd been out of it a while. Her mind slowly came back. She was on the Falcon. They'd been burning hard to the Tacoma system. She'd been in a high-G crash couch, and something had gone wrong. She tried to say what happened, but all that came out was, Wa'apa. Don't try to speak yet, her medtech said. A likable young ensign named Calvin with dark skin and features that made Elvie think his ancestors might have come from the same region of West Africa as her own. She'd never asked, because he almost certainly wouldn't know. Laconians did not share the Earther interest in ethnic origins. His face seemed to swim in and out of focus, and her mind felt weirdly disconnected from her body.
What?
She said, ignoring his advice, and then she vomited again.
Stop it, Calvin said more forcefully. You had a reaction to the sedative mix while you were under.
We had to run some tests and a procedure before we revived you to make sure we didn't do any damage. Calvin pulled a medical cuff off her arm that she hadn't even noticed was there. The needles stung as they retracted. Several tubes ran from the cuff to a drug-dispensing monitor nearby. Elvie tried to read the screen to see what they'd been pumping into her, but her eyes couldn't focus. The words remained a mysterious blur. "What?" she managed to get out without vomiting, but before she could finish, Fires burst into the room. "You woke her? Why didn't anyone call me?" he yelled at Calvin. "Let me see her chart." Fires grabbed her hand and squeezed a little too hard. Up close, she could see that his eyes were a little red and puffy. Had he been crying? "Sir," Calvin said, "she woke because the procedure had finished. All her scans are clean. No brain damage. There should be no loss of function."
"Brain damage?" Elvie croaked out. "Were we thinking brain damage?"
Her throat felt raw. Fires grabbed a plastic bottle of water with a straw and held it up to her lips. She drank greedily. Apparently she was thirsty. Good to know. "There was some concern that your breathing had been depressed," Fires said as she gulped down the water. "We just wanted to be sure." "It was unlikely," Calvin added, "but we wanted to take every precaution."
"What happened?"
Elvie finally managed to say once her thirst was quenched.
"You didn't tell her?"
Fires shot at Calvin. "Els, honey, you had a reaction to..."
"No,"
she cut him off. "I know that. Where are we? I feel gravity. Are we through the transit?" As she spoke, Calvin began putting his instruments away. It looked like whatever had happened to her, the treatment for it was over.
"Yes," Fires said. "We're in Tacoma right now. We're finishing our deceleration burn."
"I've been out that long?"
"I was scared to death, Els. I'm getting a full battery of tests run to make sure this doesn't happen again."
"Sagala's schedule won't..."
"Sagala agreed with me. I was surprised, too. I think the prospect of losing Duarte's pet biologist had him pissing his uniform."
Calvin snorted at that.
"I'm done here. Do you need anything else?"
"No," Elvie said. "Yes, when can I go back to work?"
"Now, if you feel up to it."
"Thank you, Calvin," Elvie said.
Calvin gave her a salute and a smile.
"My pleasure, Major," he said, then left the compartment.
"Maybe you should rest," Fias said.
He was frowning at her. Elvie laughed. He almost never frowned, and with his baby face, it made him look like a petulant child.
"I'm fine," she said. And then, "Okay, I'm not fine. I'll be fine. It's just travel."
"I don't like it," Fias said. She took his hand. Her skin felt sticky. She was going to need a real shower.
"So, Tacoma system," she said. "The probe said it was a neutron star."
She tried sitting up. Her head swam a little, so she stopped there.
"It is," Fires agreed, putting a hand on her back to help steady her. "But, you know, weirder."
The dizziness passed, and her eyes were focusing better as well. The text on the screens around her became actual letters and numbers.
"Help me up," she said, then dropped her feet to the floor.
Fires put an arm around her waist as she tried standing. Her legs were a little weak, but the gravity felt like they were only burning at a quarter G or so it was easy to stay upright. Fires gave her a look, then took his arm away, waiting close by to grab her if she fell. She didn't.
"I'll need some clothes," she said.
Fires nodded and opened a nearby storage locker.
"Weirder how?"
"Emptied," Fires said, then tossed her uniform and some clean underclothes on the couch. "Massive, rapidly spinning neutron star, no planets, planetoids, asteroids, nothing." Elvie pulled off the thin smock she wore in the submersion couch and headed to the shower. Fires followed her in, carrying a towel. The blast of hot water made her dizzy again, but one hand on the wall and some deep breathing exercises cleared it up in a few seconds. Faiz watched closely, but once he was sure she was all right, he relaxed. As she washed the last of the goop off her body, Elvi said, "They cleared everything out to make a diamond backup drive, too." "This is more than that. I don't mean no planetary bodies, I mean no nothing. No micrometeors, no dust, no spare protons floating around. The vacuum here is as hard as it can get." "That's okay. Weirder." Elvi turned the water off, and Fires tossed her the towel. "I mean, is that even possible?"
"No, not unless there's something keeping it clean. We're still in the Milky Way. There should be some spare crap floating through now and then. So not only is the system cleaned out, something's actively keeping it cleaned out. And get this, the gate is 5 times farther out from the star than any of the other gates. And it's above the plane of the ecliptic, 90 degrees. Don't even get me started on the star."
"What's going on with the star?"
"It's massive. I mean, like, spit on it, it'll start to collapse into a black hole level massive."
"Good that there's no spit around, then."
"Right? It turns out neutron stars aren't much to look at. Unless you can see the magnetic fields, they're just underwhelming. I mean, the densest matter possible, forces so powerful as to break space-time? Sure, bright as hell, you bet. But I was expecting a light show or something. It just looks like another sun, but smaller and kind of angry about it. This one is spinning fast enough to land in the pulsar range. We're far enough away to avoid the worst of the magnetic disturbance." She took a deep breath. She could hear the anxiety in his words. She knew what they meant. "I'm fine," she said.
"You aren't. You could have died."
"I didn't, though. And now I'll be fine."
"Okay."
Elvi finished drying off and stuffed the towel into the recycler. Faiz pulled a jar of scalp cream out of a cabinet and began rubbing it into her short, tight curls with his fingertips. It felt wonderful to have him massaging her head. "When you find a man who takes pleasure in helping you avoid dry scalp," Elvi thought, "you keep him."
"You can do that all day if you want," she said.
"If we had all day, my attentions would begin moving south," he replied with a grin.
"But we're killing our burn in about 2 hours, and I don't believe that you're going to wait one more second to start working." He closed up the cream jar and put it away while she started pulling on her clothes.
"So what were they thinking?" Elvi said.
"Hmm?
Making a neutron star so big it's hovering on the edge of collapse, and then clearing everything out of the system so that it doesn't. Moving the ring out of the ecliptic."
"You think they made a neutron star?"
"Seems more likely they just built a gate to a dud system."
"How? There had to be life here for them to hijack, or the gate wouldn't have been built. This was a living system like Sol that got turned into..."
She waved her hand.
"Yeah," Faiz agreed.
"I don't know. Honestly, this miracles and wonders thing feels like drinking from a fire hose sometimes."
Elvi finished with her uniform, then brushed her teeth as Faiz waited and watched her. She gave herself one last critical look in the mirror, then said, "Let's go see the boss." Faiz grabbed her and undid her careful uniform straightening with a hug.
"Thanks for not dying, Els."
48 hours later, they'd gone through the drill. The ship's system had analyzed the telescopic data. Elvi had gone to pay her respects to the catalyst the way she always did, and then performed the experiment. The protomolecule reached out, and the data streamed in. The Falcon searching for any change, any effect. This time, Elvi actually let herself sleep in between. Near-death experiences wore her out, apparently, even if she hadn't been aware of them at the time. In addition to which,
This time, there wasn't much to see. When they'd finished their analysis, Sagale came to the bridge and braced himself on one handhold and one foothold. His eyes shifted from one screen to the next, taking in the data streams with an air of pleasure.
Mehmet, Elvi said.
Major Okoye, Sagale said,
and nodded toward the main monitor. Magnified so that it filled the screen, the tiny but massive star was the only object within nearly 2 light-years of the Tacoma Gate.
Tell me that this system is the most important scientific discovery of all time.
No, Elvi replied.
Pretty sure the big green diamond still wins that prize. But it is amazing. The neutron star on the screen was too hot to radiate much energy as visible light, but the screen still had to dim it down to keep it from blinding everyone in the room.
More than 3 stellar masses stuffed into a ball half the size of Rhode Island, Jen said.
What's a Rhode Island?
Trevon asked. He'd been a Martian back before they were all Laconians.
Major Okoye, Sagale said, ignoring the banter. Am I correct that this is exactly what it looks like? A single unusable star in a system devoid of other artifacts or exploitable planets?
Something in his tone caught Elvi's attention. It had a stiff formality to it, as though he were asking her questions under oath. She felt like they were engaging in some sort of ritual that he understood and she didn't.
That's what it looks like, she said carefully.
Yes. Sagale nodded his massive head at her. The pleasure seemed to radiate from him.
Come to my office in 5 minutes.
He pulled himself away, disappearing down the corridor. Faez met her gaze and lifted an eyebrow.
Makes me nervous too, she said.
She checked the data one last time, like she was going over her class notes before a test. She had a sense that there was something in it she'd overlooked. It wasn't a feeling she liked.
Coffee?
Sagale asked when she arrived. He was floating next to the beverage machine inset in one of the bulkheads of his office. 2 drinking bulbs drifted next to him. It was the first time he'd ever offered her anything in hospitality. It made her nervous.
Sure,
she said, so that he wouldn't notice. The machine hissed as it injected cups of coffee into the bulbs one at a time.
Sweetener? Whitener?
Sagale asked, still fussing with the machine.
No.
Sagale turned to her and gently pushed one of the bulbs in her direction. She caught it and depressed the bubble on the lid that opened the flow to the drinking tube, then took a sip. The coffee was just right, hot but not scalding, bitter and strong and vaguely nutty.
Thank you,
she said, waiting for the other shoe to drop.
I want to extend the thanks of the Laconian Empire for your work on this project. Now that we have identified a system of no utility, we are moving to the military phase of the operation, Sagale said after a short pause while he sipped at his coffee.
The what?
2 ships are entering this system as we speak, he said. They are both uncrewed and controlled remotely from this vessel. Both are large freighters. One is empty. The other has a payload.
A payload?
The High Council has been able to use the construction platforms over Laconia to isolate and contain antimatter. The second ship is carrying slightly over 20 kilograms in a magnetic containment device.
Elvi felt lightheaded again. Maybe she was still recovering from her near-death experience. Maybe it was her superior officer telling her that he had enough explosive power to glass the surface of a planet. Probably it was both. She took a moment to get her breath back.
And why? She asked.
The High Council's directive for this expedition was twofold, Sagale said. The first was the mission you were briefed about. You and your team have done all that could be asked in this effort, and my reports back to Naval Command reflect this.
Okay, thanks. What was the second thing?
Elvi asked. The second aspect of this mission is outside your expertise, which is why it was kept on a need-to-know basis. We were to find a gate-connected system with minimal value, such as this one. She let go of the coffee bulb, and it began gently floating away. Am I allowed to know what Phase Two is? Because if I don't need to know, it seems sort of mean to have this conversation.
You are.
In fact, you are essential to it. And I have every confidence that you will continue to excel as our mission changes, though you will no longer have operational command, Sigale said. There was something like sympathy in his eyes. For the very first time, Elvie got the sense that Sigale liked her, or at least respected her. The High Council's first priority is to find a way to defend humanity against whatever destroyed the gate builders. He paused for a moment, like he didn't quite believe what he was about to say, like he'd been waiting for a long time to say it. The test we are about to perform is the beginning of that process. He tapped at his desk, and a map of the Tacoma system appeared above it, the neutron star at its center, the distant gate, the Falcon floating at the midway point, and the two new freighters drifting near the entry point. We are going to monitor this system with every instrument at our disposal, just as we always have, Sigale said. But this time, out in the hub network, traffic control is running ships through the gates until the energy transfer load reaches the critical state. When the critical level is reached, we are going to transit the empty freighter from this system.
You're going to deliberately Dutchman a ship?
We are. When it vanishes, and while the energy transfer load is still high enough to make transits impossible, I will set the trigger on the antimatter containment field and transit the second ship. It too should vanish, but it will have a timer set to detonate the load. Elvie felt her stomach cramp up like he'd punched her in the solar plexus. It was suddenly hard to breathe.
Why would you?
Because one of two things is true, Sigale said. Either there is an intelligence that lies beyond those gates that is making the choice to destroy our ships, or there is some natural effect of the gate system itself that does it. This is how we will determine that.
Elvie reached for a handhold in the bulkhead behind her and pulled herself to the wall. Her heart was going faster.
You think you can kill them?
That isn't the issue. Whether something on the other side dies or doesn't die, what matters is that it is punished. After this experiment, some time later, we will run the energy up to the point of another Dutchman and see if the ship is taken. If the ship survives transit, we will know the bomb convinced our opponent to change their stance toward us.
That's a terrible plan.
If it does change, we'll know the enemy is capable of change. That it's intentional and possibly intelligent. If not, we'll repeat the test until we're reasonably certain that no change will be forthcoming. I take it from your expression that you have some thoughts on the mission you'd like to share.
Elvie's voice sounded outraged, even to her.
The last time we made them angry, they turned off every consciousness in the Sol system, and there was a massive surge in virtual particle activity. They fired a bullet that broke spooky interactions in ways we're still trying to make sense of. Every one of those things defies our understanding of how reality works. So we're going to throw a bomb at them?
Sigale nodded, agreeing and dismissing her at the same time.
If we could send a sternly worded letter, we'd try that. But this is how you negotiate with something that you can't speak to. When it does something we don't like, we hurt it. Every time it does something we don't like, we hurt it again. Only once. If it can understand cause and effect, it will get our message.
Jesus!
We aren't the aggressor here. We didn't hit anyone first. We just haven't hit anyone back until now.
She could hear Winston Duarte in the word choices, even in the cadence Sigale delivered them with.
It made Elvie want to throw her coffee bulb at his face. Fortunately, it had drifted several meters away, saving her from a court-martial.
Thanks to you, we've found a sample system. This is the safest place in the Empire for humanity to conduct these tests.
This is a bad, bad idea. I don't think you're hearing what I'm saying.
When humans first began experimenting with fission bombs, Sigalis said, as if she hadn't spoken, they used empty islands for their tests. Consider this our Bikini Atoll.
Elvie laughed at him, but there was no humor in it.
My God, you people really are this dumb, she said.
Sigalis frowned at that, but she powered on anyway.
First of all, the Bikini Atoll wasn't empty. The people that lived there had their homes stolen and were sent away, and the islands were filled with plant and animal life that was annihilated.
We have established that this system has nothing that...
Elvie didn't let him finish. But putting that aside for a moment, I just said whatever lives inside those gates has a very different understanding of physics than we do. Is it limited to taking its anger out on only one solar system? You don't know that. You can't know that.
Passivity didn't save the gate builders. It won't save us. The High Council has considered the risks and judged a proactive, direct path to be the best option available.
He spread his hands.
What can be done?
As if Duarte's word were a force of nature, inescapable and unquestionable. It was like talking to a recording.
You are about to run an N equals one experiment, where one is the number of universes we can break, trying to satisfy Duarte's curiosity.
Chapter 11. Alex. The shipyards on Callisto were a perfect example of the old idea that ships and buildings keep learning, even after they're built. History took whatever it found and used it for what was happening at the time, remaking the spaces into whatever worked well enough to get by at the moment, until history itself became a kind of architect. Callisto had been a divided base once, pretty much the same way medieval villages had been built just outside castle walls. Civilian shipyards had grown up around the older MCRN base until the military and commercial concerns were almost the same size. The Free Navy had raided the Martian side even before the Free Navy really existed, pounding that half of the base into dust and bodies. Then, in the aftermath of the great defection that became the seeds of Laconia, the rebuilding of the Martian shipyards had been left incomplete. During the starving years, it had been abandoned. But the real estate was there. And as the need grew again, what had been military structures were taken over again. Nothing died without becoming the foundation for what came after. They had been on Callisto for 8 days so far, and it wasn't certain when they'd ship back out. There were several of the big cargo ships in Sol System that might be able to smuggle the storm, if that was what the Underground decided to do next. Or maybe they'd stay in Sol. For all Laconia's ambitions, there were still more people, stations, and ships in the Sol system than outside it. That was changing, though. Someday, within Alex's lifetime, they'd cross the threshold, and Sol really would be just one system among many. The oldest, most human system in the Empire, sure, but not home. There would be 1,000 homes. And, if history was a guide, in a generation or two, everyone would think wherever they were was the most important one. The restaurant Casper had taken him to, for example, was in a reinforced dome that had clearly been Martian military construction. A supply depot, probably. Now all the fail-closed locks were gone, and the reinforced walls were hung with batiked cloth and the kind of tapestry that interior decorators churned out by the square meter. The menu billed itself as Moroccan, but the couscous was made with mushrooms, and the beef all had the overly consistent grain that meant it had grown in a vat.
The recipes might have had their roots on Earth, but Alex knew Belter food when he tasted it. He and Casper and the rest of the crew wore printed flight suits with a triangle and curve logo that implied they worked for a gas mining